From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Alan Shipton is my guest. A jazz musician as well as an author and BBC radio personality, Alan Shipton has written biographies of jazz greats Fats Waller, Bud Powell, and Dizzy Gillespie, as well as lots of other books. His latest is a long-needed full-length biography of Harry Nilsson, and it is called Nilsson, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter. Alan Shipton, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. Very nice to be here.
So you write a lot about jazz and jazz music. So how did you come to write about Harry Nilsson?
I was actually in Los Angeles making a radio program about the producer Richard Perry, who has some jazz connections in that he made records with Ella Fitzgerald and Fats Domino. And I was chatting to Richard about some of the albums he'd made, and I got really interested to discover that it was he who'd produced Nilsson Schmilsson and Son of Schmilsson, which, in my view, are two of Harry Nilsson's greatest albums. And I said to Richard, I'd really like to know more about Harry. Is there a book? And he said, no, there isn't, and there never has been. I think partly because, he said, the Nilsson estate had not decided whether they wanted to authorize a book, and also Harry's widow had been very distressed when he died and felt that perhaps she should just shut everything away and not think about it, which is exactly what had happened. So it was a perfect gift for a biographer in that there was a lot of material. Harry had kept scrapbooks, he'd actually started writing an autobiography, but none of this had actually been turned into a current project, and it was quite a long time since that conversation with Richard before I was able actually to agree with the estates a means of access to all that material and start writing.
And did you do a lot of interviewing?
Yes, I did, but I was also greatly helped. I must pay credit to John Scheinfeld, who made a film called Who is Harry Nilsson and Why is Everybody Talking About Him, which is a very fine television documentary. And he'd interviewed a lot of people in the early 2000s, many of whom are no longer with us, including Harry's second wife, Deanne, and some other colleagues of Harry's. So John very kindly gave me access to his unedited interviews. But then I really felt that I had to start re-interviewing people myself, because as ever with a biography, you start uncovering questions and you need to go to people who are around to answer them. And I was tremendously helped by a number of Harry's friends. I think I should single out in particular Van Dyke Parks, who was the sort of musical director on a number of the albums, and also Perry Botkin Jr. And Perry's very interesting because when Nilsson's career began, he was there and he saw him right through till the very end. So Perry had a wonderful kind of bird's eye view of the whole parabola, and indeed in many ways rather tragic parabola, of Harry's career.
Yeah, a parabola with Nilsson Schmilsson kind of at the top of it.
Yes, and I think those two albums he made with Richard Perry are probably the musical high point, although the second one, Son of Schmilsson, was never the great commercial success that it could have been, I think because of Harry's insistence in that perhaps the best-known song on that record is peppered with four-letter words.
Yeah. Well, not just the musical highlight of his life, but the highlight of his life. I mean, that kind of everything went downhill from there for him, yes?
Well, on Nilsson Schmilsson was, of course, the famous version of Without You, which is a tremendous song, and probably the one, along with Everybody's Talking from Midnight Cowboy, for which Harry Nilsson is best known. Mm-hmm. And there is a theory, and I think I share this with numerous of Harry's friends and associates to whom I talked, that when Harry achieved that, he'd somehow ticked all the boxes. You have to imagine that this is a boy who'd had a very troubled childhood, which I go into some detail about in the book, and he got a job, against all odds actually, and indeed by lying about his curriculum vitae, in a bank, and he was working in a bank, and with an incredible constitution, he'd be working a night shift in the bank, finishing at 1 or 2 in the morning, writing songs all night, dozing off at around 6 a.m., and at 9, refreshed by a cup of coffee, go out and try and sell his songs to publishers. So this was a man who didn't need a lot of sleep, but for 6 years he did this job and started selling his wares as a songwriter, and indeed selling his talents as a singer. And there were no great successes from that period, but ultimately it was the work that he did then that launched his career. He was constantly very hungry as an artist.
Yeah.
And so this fueled him. And when he won a Grammy for Everybody's Talking and another one for Without You, and his album sold around 6 million copies, this is suddenly the moment at which he had ticked the boxes and started to enjoy, and I mean enjoy with a capital letter right the way through, the rock and roll lifestyle.
Now, he had been an early computer operator over there at the bank.
This was something that was just coming in, and it's also important to know that Nilsson, as well as being very musically talented, had a gift for mathematics. He was the sort of person who would say to you, what was the date of your birth? You'd tell him, and immediately he'd know the day of the week on which you were born and could tell you. It's apparently a matter of a number of simple calculations, but he had the kind of brain that didn't even make itself aware of the calculations. He could just do it and tell you. And he was like that in a number of mathematical areas. He was not somebody I'd like to have played cards with, for example, because he remembered cards and he remembered numbers and sequences, and this was something that he just could do instinctively. So when computing came along, he was the ideal candidate to operate these rooms full of whirring machinery, men in white coats running around, and I think they were exclusively men in those days, in the bank in Van Nuys, California. And this was the beginning of an era which, you know, we all know about now with machine-readable codes and cards for getting money out of the hole in the wall and all that. But this was all in its infancy, and Harry was there from the start.
Now, you're from a place called England. We've heard of this place.
I expect my accent gives me away.
And Harry Nilsson kind of maybe even more popular over there than here?
I think England was his adopted home because he felt somehow that there were things about the country he liked. He made the album Nilsson Schmilsson there, and I mean, I suppose if your greatest success has come out of working in London, that might colour your view about the place and so on. But also, it was the home of the Beatles, and they adored Harry. There's absolutely no question about that. They heard him in his very early days as a recording artist, and he managed to show in almost everything he did that he had absorbed their work. I mean, even before his more famous work using Beatles songs on the album Pandemonium Shadow Show, he'd actually done a curious little song called All for the Beatles, which coincided with their appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. They took footage of that and made what I suppose was the first audio-visual release in the United States, which was a 7-inch single, glued to the cover of which was a reel of 8mm film showing the Beatles arriving and they're being mobbed by lots of girls. And the idea was you put your record on the gramophone and then you put the film on your film projector, and when a certain sequence of pips arrived on the screen, you started the record, and then you were able to watch and listen at the same time. And Harry dubbed the voice of all four Beatles on that, and you get a very convincing impression that this is a Beatles song. It's actually Nilsson being all of them.
Yes, I remember you saying in your book that he really admired the voice actor, is it Paul Frees, who did the voice in his animated film, in Nilsson's animated film, The Point, but he also was the guy who did all the Beatles' animated voices in that.
Yeah, and he was just one of those incredibly versatile Hollywood actors who did voiceovers. And I mean, he was the sort of person who one minute, I can't remember if he played some of the more absurd cartoon characters in other cartoons, but he could do everything from sort of hillbilly voices to sort of English baddies. And he managed to do that with great aplomb, and Harry adored this idea of using somebody who had a direct connection with the Beatles' voices.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. No is the saddest experience you'll ever know. Yes, it's the saddest experience you'll ever know. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the greatest number that you'll ever know. It's just no good anymore since you went away. Now I spend my time just making rhymes of yesterday.
We're talking with Alan Shipton, and he's written a number of books, including I Feel a Song Coming On, The Life of Jimmy McHugh, the great songwriter. But we're talking about his new book, which is called Nielsen, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter. What do you think is worse, drugs or alcohol?
Well, there's a curious anomaly here in Harry, and it reminds me of a conversation I overheard between the former Justice Secretary of the UK, Kenneth Clark, and a Scottish playwright, Mike Moran, who were discussing Chet Baker, who had a very similar trajectory into drugs and alcohol abuse. And Kenneth was saying, well, just think what a career Chet would have had if he hadn't taken drugs and drunk a lot. And Mike said, no, you've got it all wrong, Ken. Chet liked taking drugs. He liked having a drink. And I think the same is true of Harry. So at one level, yes, there's no doubt that his career might have been different if he hadn't drunk a lot and ingested a lot of substances. But the other way of looking at it is that he was actually extraordinarily productive. Even though the things that he produced varied wildly in quality, there are some great moments in the work that Harry produced, and he never really stopped working until the moment that John Lennon was shot. So you have a moment from Nielsen Schmielsen appearing in the early 1970s right through to the end of the decade. Lennon is shot at the beginning of the 80s. And for those 8 years, Harry is producing one or two albums a year, writing film scores, appearing in various different guises. He never appeared live, by the way, on stage. This was another quirk of Harry's career. But he was busy all the time, despite an intake of drugs and alcohol that would have killed most people in a few days.
No, it did eventually kill him. But, I mean, you know,
yes,
he died of a heart attack, but... But yes. he was quite young.
He just entered his 50s at the time, so he was, I think, 53 when he died, coming up for that. And that's no age at all in the world of show business. And you think of so many of his contemporaries who are still making records, recording, and coming up with great work, people like Jimmy Webb or Van Dyke Parks.
Paul McCartney comes to mind.
Paul McCartney, of course. And, you know, and even Ringo Starr, who's touring with the All-Star Band. We saw Ringo in Britain last year, touring with the band, and he was, of course, Harry's other great running mate and friend. And I think they may, in their wildest moments, have ingested various things together. But nonetheless, Ringo was tougher and survived and still plays.
Yeah.
Not something that Harry didn't.
Well, I went to the Troubadour one night to see the Smothers Brothers. I went to the early show. It was their first gig after, I think it had been 5 years after they'd been fired by CBS. And it was a great show. I saw Paul Newman in the audience. And then I left. I didn't stay for the second show. Had I stayed, Harry Nielsen and John Lennon would have been there.
And you would have seen Lennon ingesting a number of Brandy Alexanders in no time flat and being chucked out by the bouncers after heckling in the most vigorous manner. And, yes, I think they weren't very good for each other in some respects, socially, Harry and John. They did egg each other on into outrageous behaviour. Possibly after an atmosphere of complete unreality, because during that era, the two of them had been involved in Lennon recording for Phil Spector, and even though the behaviour which ended up with Phil Spector being imprisoned more recently was not at its height, it was still pretty odd at that period. And I think if you'd been working in the studio with a man who turned up one day dressed as a cowboy, another day dressed as a doctor, and all sorts of other things, you might have somehow become a little detached from reality. And so I think I forgive them for that episode, in the sense that they had been existing in a plane that most ordinary mortals don't.
Yeah, of course. Like, you know, if I had to borrow somebody's car, you know, I would probably take really good care of it.
Yes, and not long after this incident, there's a great episode in the book and in Harry's life where he and the producer, Stanley Dorfman, who is a great friend of mine. I mean, Stanley is a wonderful film producer. He produced Top of the Pops in the UK. He produced a series called In Concert, which, as a result, created the two finest films of Nielsen actually performing. He wasn't performing for a real audience, he was just performing in the studio, but Stanley made these films, became a very, very close friend of Nielsen. And when I was working on the book, we discovered that Stanley and I share a birthday, so we've become quite good friends since. And Stanley had never, he was actually from South Africa originally, but he'd lived and worked in the UK. He'd been over in Los Angeles trying to recruit other singers to appear on his In Concert series for the BBC. Got together with Harry, and going out for an evening with Harry often took 2 or 3 days and ended up somewhere completely unexpected. In this case, going out with Harry involved borrowing a car from Jimmy Webb for the afternoon and ending up, having started in Los Angeles, in New York.
Yes, and in the process of traveling across the country, they completely trashed the car.
They did, and it was returned on a railway truck to Jimmy, who could not believe the state in which the car, already more or less totaled by this drive across the states, had then been exposed to the elements on a flatbed railway truck for a couple of weeks as it made its way around various freight yards across the states and eventually back to him. But to give Harry his due, he refurbished the car, and Jimmy always said it was better after it was put back together than it had been before.
They seem like an odd pair of friends, Jimmy Webb and Harry Nielsen. Jimmy Webb, very serious guy.
I think they almost got off to a very bad start. They were first introduced to one another at a Hollywood party, in fact, at the home of David Geffen, and there was a little note on the sleeve of one of Jimmy's records that said BHN, which meant before Harry Nielsen, and he used a little line in a lyric about a stone skipping over the water, which of course is an image that appears in Everybody's Talking, and Harry took exception to this. And so there was almost a sort of punch-up at this party. Fortunately, they realized that they shared something very important in life, which is a sense of humor. And I think that was the fundamental business, that Harry was a very generous, very warm, very funny man. And this is an element in Jimmy. I mean, Jimmy's been incredibly kind to me over the book as well. And it's interesting. I'd got actually to see him at a very early stage in writing. He was performing with Michael Feinstein in what was Feinstein's bar in the Hollywood Roosevelt in Los Angeles, in Hollywood Boulevard. And it was great to see the two of them performing. I was introduced to him for an instant after the show. And then, unfortunately, I was hijacked by Lorna Luft, who was the daughter of Judy Garland, who I just reviewed in Concert in Britain. And she wanted to tell me how much she'd enjoyed my review of her concert. When I turned back, Jimmy had discreetly disappeared. And it took some time for us to get back in touch to talk about Harry, but I'm glad to say he was very generous about the book, and certainly was an insight into this very unlikely, as you say, but very deep friendship with Harry.
Well, I can't forget this evening, or your face as you were leaving, but I guess that's just the way the story goes. You always smile, but in your eyes your sorrow shows.
We're talking with Alan Shipton. His new book is called Nielsen, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter. And Nielsen's early albums, you know, they kind of look like singer-songwriter albums, but the album cover of Nielsen Schmielsen, he looks terrible. He's got this, so he's reaching into his refrigerator, he's got this bathrobe on. That's kind of an odd cover, is it not?
I think all the covers are a bit strange until you realize that the Harry Nielsen that didn't want to appear in public on stage also didn't really want to present himself on the covers of his albums. So if you think about them in sequence, Pandemonium Shadow Show is a sort of surrealist montage with Harry sitting in a set of props that all have some kind of arcane connection with the lyrics of the album. He's a suited bank clerk there, but you'd probably not recognise him if he walked down the street. The next two albums have drawings of Harry or a photograph of the very young Harry. The Point has a piece of embroidery which has nothing to do with Nielsen himself. Skidoo, which was the soundtrack to a film, probably one of the worst films ever made by Otto Preminger.
Worst film.
Absolutely, and some wonderful music by Nielsen that really sank without trace because of the film being so awful. But that, again, is a picture of somebody wearing a sort of helicopter blade on a hat, which you wouldn't recognise as being anything to do with Nielsen. So right the way through, these albums don't really give you a picture of the man. It's not until Sandman, where you see the rather avuncular bearded Nielsen sitting on the beach on one side, and then have the impression that he's been consumed by an enormous crab on the other, that you even see a picture of Harry looking more or less as he looked in everyday life. And even then, I'm not sure that if you'd walked past the pier in Venice and actually looked up and you'd seen this sort of chubby chap with a beard wandering by, you'd ever have realized it was Harry Nielsen.
You mentioned these great films of the In Concert series. There's two of them, right?
Yes. And well, the second one is a little bit different. It's the entire output of A Little Touch of Schmielsen in the Night with Gordon Jenkins and his orchestra, recorded in the BBC Radio Theatre. But it's actually one of the very early attempts to put on film an entire album. So it's not quite the same as the In Concert film, but nonetheless very similar.
And you've seen these. Where are they available? Are they commercially available?
How shall I put this? They are strictly illegally, but rather wonderfully available on YouTube.
Ah.
And so you can see most of this material. I'm privileged because I do work for the BBC, and I was able to obtain copies to look at from the BBC.
There must be lots of great stuff in the BBC archives there that you can...
I think it's one of the great sadnesses of Stanley Dorfman's career that some of the great movies that he made of pop stars, rock stars, and indeed jazz groups have not seen the light of day since. So, for example, for me as a jazz enthusiast, his films of Duke Ellington, Woody Herman, Stan Kenton have not been transmitted since the 1960s.
But they still exist.
They still exist.
Now you've been at the BBC for close to 30 years, haven't you?
25.
Yeah, and you do a jazz program. People write in and tell you what records they want to hear, and you...
Yes, Jazz Record Request has been running about the same length of time as the late Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz, so it's one of the two longest-running jazz programs on the air, and I'm only, I think, the fifth presenter it's ever had in that life, so it's a great honor and privilege to follow in the footsteps of people like Humphrey Littleton, Steve Race, who are great musicians, and the broadcasters Charles Fox, Jeffrey Smith, and Peter Clayton, all of whom are sort of in some ways or another mentors to me, so it's been great to have this opportunity and to connect every week with the jazz community, not just in Britain, but around the world. And I should say at the same time that before this, I did for 6 years a program on the BBC World Service, which was very widely heard here in the United States, which was called Jazzmatazz. And it was great working for the World Service. I had an audience at that time in excess of 160 million, which, you know, in radio figures is just so unbelievably large, you can't really compute it, but...
We have just about that here for From the Bookshelf, a little tiny bit less.
I'm very glad to hear that, Gary. And of course, the podcasts make a big difference.
Oh, yes.
But Jazzmatazz was extraordinary, and we were getting letters from... I treasure a letter I got from Ulaanbaatar in Outer Mongolia, as I think the most extraordinary place to have requests from. But all over Africa, all over Asia, it was just a great experience. And I feel that same connection now with listeners who write in to Jazz Record Requests because, of course, online you can hear it anywhere in the world, and that is a great privilege.
And you're so good at it, and I'm glad you're doing it.
Well, that's very kind of you. It's been great fun to do.
Well, now, this book about Nielsen is it's a wonderful book, and it's a very scholarly book. It's really well written, and it's well researched, annotated, and so forth. How long did you work on this book?
Well, on and off. I suppose I worked on it for about 8 years, because after that initial meeting with Richard Perry, which was 10 years ago, I was actually just finishing the book on Jimmy McHugh, which you mentioned a little while ago. And then I had another obligation to finish a book that I'd started on many years before on Cab Calloway. So I had to get both those books written, and while I was finishing those, I was also negotiating the complex business of getting in touch with the estate, getting clearance to use some of Nielsen's own writings about himself. And so I suppose the actual writing of the book took about 3 years, but there had been a five-year preamble of beginning to learn about his stuff, listening to all the music in detail, tracking down odd bits of film, tracking down those BBC broadcasts we mentioned, so that when I actually started the book, I had a clear run at it.
Were you surprised when you discovered all these things about his family and things? There's a lot of surprises in the story. Did you know about all that in advance, or as you were starting to do the research, you said, oh, gosh, look at this?
Well, I have to say the family were tremendously helpful, and I'm very grateful to two people, one of whom I knew about at the start and one of whom I discovered during the process. Harry had two half-brothers who were very helpful to me. Gary, who is the son of his father, second marriage, and Drake Nielsen, who is the son of his mother. And Drake was a complete mystery. Harry didn't know he existed until he became famous. Drake saw Harry's picture on the cover of one of the albums, in fact the Harry album, which shows a very young Harry, and recognized him and made efforts to contact him. And I have to say that it's been a great delight to meet Drake. If he is listening to this program, and I know he's an avid listener to programs that have anything to do with his brother, I'd like to thank him for the hat that he recently sent me through the mail. But we've become great friends, and I feel very nice to know that somebody who was sort of abandoned by Harry's exceedingly eccentric mother, Betty, was then welcomed back into the family circle, has been very kind to me in writing the book. And it's an extraordinary story, and it's laid bare in the book for the first time.
Oh, Alan Shipton, what are you going to write about next?
Well, my next book is actually coming out fairly soon. It will be appearing in January, and it couldn't be more different. I've been working with the British bandleader Chris Barber on his autobiography. So it's a book rather like the one I did a few years ago with George Shearing, where I'm sort of a ghostwriter, but I get credit. And I've been working with him on his memoirs. And Chris is interesting, I should just say, because he was the first guy to bring into Britain all the great blues artists of the 50s. So Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, all these people had never appeared in Britain before Chris. But of course, he was also the man who brought traditional jazz back to the forefront here in the United States, in that his band came here first in 1961 with a number one hit with Petite Fleur, and he appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show and had a lot to do with repopularizing traditional jazz in the United States at a time when it was almost forgotten.
Well, Alan Shipton, now that we're best friends, would you come back and talk to us when your next book comes out?
I'd be delighted.
Thanks for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much, Gary.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Alan Shipton. His latest book is called Nielsen, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.